You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show... As the last full day of campaigning in Scotland's historic independence referendum draws to a close, we'll assess why the race continues to be too close to call. I'll be joined by Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London and the journalist Samira Shackle to discuss that and more of the day's key news stories from around the world. And a little later...
Malik Saab, you're not a minister anymore! You're not a minister anymore! And even if you're a minister, we don't care! We don't care anymore!
A group of disgruntled air passengers in Pakistan forced the removal of two politicians from the aircraft after the two men left them waiting on the runway for 2 hours. We'll assess whether this marks a change in the political process in the country. And we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, review the week's theatre openings, and meet the photographer who has chronicled the workspaces of artists in a new book. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Both sides in Scotland's independence referendum are making their final pitches to voters ahead of Thursday's vote. Polls continue to suggest it's too close to call between the yes and no camps, and it's thought as many as 500,000 people still haven't decided which way they'll vote. The British Prime Minister David Cameron is appealing to Scottish voters not to break up the United Kingdom.
Everyone who cares about our United Kingdom, and I care passionately about our United Kingdom, is nervous, but I'm confident that we've set out how Scotland can have the best of both worlds. Of course, the vote is a matter for people in Scotland to decide, but I know that Conservatives across the United Kingdom, just as Labour and Liberal Democrat voters across the United Kingdom, will be saying, it's your choice, but be in no doubt, we'd like you to stay.
President Obama has insisted American troops will not be sent into Iraq to fight Islamic State militants. He's been speaking to an audience of soldiers, sailors, and airmen in Florida in the last hour, after sanctioning a wider campaign against the Islamists who have taken control of large parts of Iraq and Syria. He says the U.S. will help Iraq's own forces to defeat the militants, but won't lead the fight.
As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq. After a decade of massive ground deployments, it is more effective to use our unique capabilities in support of partners on the ground so they can secure their own country's futures.
Activists claim almost 50 people have been killed in airstrikes in Syria carried out by government forces. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least 6 children were killed in strikes in the province of Homs, as well as a dozen rebel fighters. Syrian state media claims a gathering of terrorists was targeted. There have been gunshots and explosions at a college in the north of Nigeria. People have been seen running from the teacher training college in Kano. Suspicion for the attack is likely to center on Boko Haram, the militant group behind a series of strikes across the north of Nigeria. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa could destroy the economies of the worst affected countries, according to the World Bank. It says only a speedy global response can prevent the collapse in Liberia, Guinea and Sierra Leone. Already almost 2,500 people have died. Ministers from East African governments have been meeting to discuss how to keep Ebola out of their countries. Khadija Katachun is from Kenya's Ministry of Health.
We at the East African community, we have this agreement that enables people to move freely across the borders. So it means that at that point, we need to seal our borders and ensure that the people within the region are not affected by Ebola.
Ukraine's government has announced plans to test 1 million civil servants on their loyalty. Officials say all staff who worked under the previous president, Viktor Yanukovych, will be vetted. The law has been introduced on the same day that the parliament approved self-rule for the eastern regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. That was part of the ceasefire agreement with pro-Russian rebels. though they say they will continue to demand outright independence. In Tunisia, police say they have killed two Islamist militants in clashes close to the border with Algeria. Thousands of troops have been deployed in the region, and the country's security alert level has been raised ahead of next month's elections. Ministers have warned the militants plan to disrupt the vote in an attempt to derail the country's democratic process. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. Paul will be back in the studio with more news headlines in about 25 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich, London,
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti chei chei chei.
From London,
London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time in Moscow is 21:06, here in London 18:06, and in New York City it is 13:06. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London and the journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. In about 13 hours' time, polling booths across Scotland will open in the country's historic independence referendum. The latest opinion polls suggest the No campaign are in the lead, but only by the slimmest of margins, making this extraordinary campaign still too close to call. Well, before we come to you, Samira and Nina, I'm joined by Monocle's Thomas Lewis, who has been covering the campaign for us. Hello, Thomas. So when you've been looking at the developments in Scotland today, what have you found most interesting?
Well, I think this final day of the campaign has really been marked by noise and the fervour, really, of both sides. I mean, we should all remind ourselves, really, how extraordinary a scenario this is. This is a process that's been going for about 2 years now. And I think from a UK point of view, it's only really the last 2 weeks or so that, say, the media that's based in London here, and even the populations in Wales and Northern Ireland have really woken up to how realistic a prospect this is. So we've seen across Scotland today huge rallies on both sides, both claiming to have the momentum. Now we can look at the opinion polls, three of which came out last night, suggesting that the No camp had a very slim lead, but actually that those numbers do fall within the margin of error. So actually it still does mean that the whole thing is too close to call, and you can see why, therefore, that both campaigns have filled the streets of cities and towns across Scotland today and will likely do so tomorrow too.
So how exactly is the vote going to happen? I already mentioned the polling booths are opening at 7 a.m. in Scotland. How does this all work?
So how it all works is, yes, the polling booths open at 7 a.m. They'll be open until 10 p.m. And people across Scotland will be voting all day. Let's not forget, though, that people have been voting already. I think it's about one in five, they think, maybe that high, of voters have been voting by post for a couple of weeks. So tomorrow the polling booths open. They are located in 32 areas across Scotland. They're the local authority areas. And when the polling booths close at 10 p.m., that's when the count starts. Now, turnout is expected to be incredibly high. If you look at the number of people who've registered to take part in this referendum, it's 97% of the 4 million or so people who are eligible to vote. Now, that's a record in itself. So people believe that actually the turnout will be 80%, maybe even 85%. So that means that the number of votes, therefore, to physically count is going to be incredibly high, which could hold up the process. It's also worth noting as well that actually both campaigns have one recount decision in each of these 32 areas. Now, that would mean if a vote comes in that's very close to call, that either the Yes campaign or the No campaign could say, actually, no, we want to recount that and check. Now, that obviously will take more time. And some people believe that the stakes are so high here and that the numbers will be so tight that actually there might be nothing to lose for either side to say, actually, let's recount this anyway. So we are expecting a full result at around 7 a.m. on Friday morning. But of course, Scotland is a very diverse territory. Getting the votes from all the far corners up in the rural parts of Scotland will take time too. So 7 a.m. is around the time we're looking at on Friday morning.
And just before I let you go, finally, what is going to happen if we get a yes vote from there? What are the first actions?
That is the million-dollar question, I suppose. I suppose what the problem maybe both campaigns have had is actually saying, well, in reality, what does this mean? How will we see independence in the air, if you like, if it is a yes vote? Now, Alex Salmond himself, the First Minister of Scotland, who's been leading the yes campaign, has said that if it is a yes vote, of course, the celebration will take precedent initially. But he has said that this idea of starting the negotiations of how actually a yes vote transforms into a solid independent Scotland will begin almost straight away. And of course, from the no camp, Gordon Brown, the former British Prime Minister, has laid out a table for negotiations of the things that would be changed from a British government point of view should a no vote prevail. Now, I think we're looking at, say, November there for an initial proposal, and then with legislation being drafted in January. Now, I think what will happen if it is a yes vote, I mean, I think there will be a great sense of disbelief. We don't know the impact it will have down in Westminster. There have been questions asked already whether Prime Minister David Cameron will be able to remain in his position as Prime Minister if there is a yes vote. So I think tumult, without being too dramatic about it, either side, either way the vote goes, is what we can expect in the early hours of Friday morning.
That is Monocle's Thomas Lewis. And you can hear Thomas' documentary on this historic referendum. It's called Scotland's Choice on tonight's edition of the Monocle Daily. That is at 22:30 London time, 17:30 in New York City. But let's get this roundtable discussion started now. So Nina, this is indeed a vote that has caught a lot of people by surprise. What is your impression of what we've seen in Scotland during the recent days?
Well, I think that the first thing to point out is that there's been a remarkable amount of complacency, at least on the Westminster side. Perhaps they didn't realise how emotive this issue is, and we only started to see opinion turn when the first poll put the Yes campaign in the lead, and then all of a sudden all the leaders were going up to Scotland to start campaigning. I think something remarkable about Salmond's very successful campaign is that there are a lot of questions that he's left unanswered, one of them being, you know, what currency Scotland will have and what its position will be with regards to the rest of the UK and also its place in the rest of the EU. Now, Salmond has been saying that they'll be able to keep the pound and they'll also be an EU member, but that will require a lot of negotiations. He said these kind of negotiations with the EU, rejoining the EU, will take 18 months. It's not going to be 18 months. It's going to be a very long process. And the interesting thing is that all other countries in the EU will have a veto on the 35 chapters of negotiations that Scotland will have to undertake with the rest of the EU. So that could mean a rump, you know, United Kingdom, the leftover UK, might be wanting to make Scotland's transition a little bit difficult. But also other countries are watching with great interest, most notably Spain, because they have their own independence movements going on. And of course, people in Catalonia will be looking to the referendum with great interest tomorrow because it has bearing on their own independence movement.
It is a very important point you make over there about how many questions are still unanswered. Do you think, Samira, do you think this is something, you know, the uncertainty, do you think that is something that actually affects the results? And do you think the Scottish people will actually dare to take the risk that they actually go for the independence without actually knowing what's going to lead into?
I mean, it's a good question. And I think that a lot of what's made the Yes campaign very effective is that it's not really been a campaign about rationale, about sensible reasons, about sort of thought through policies. It's been a campaign of the heart rather than the head. And I think that makes it something very difficult to argue against, because then the No campaign just comes across as very negative, sort of sticklers for the rules, when actually what the Yes campaign has traded on and what Salmond is incredibly effective at doing on a personal level is sort of this nationalist sentiment, patriotism, all those sort of emotional reasons, which I think are certainly important when you're talking about national self-determination. It's not to say that those sorts of emotional feelings about nation and so on are not important, but they're not the be-all and end-all. And I think certainly if there were to be a yes vote, there'd be a huge number of questions to be answered. I mean, the fact that it's as basic as currency not being decided is quite amazing, really. And the other thing is that if it does pass, it's going to be with a very, very small margin, which means that you'll have to sort of reconcile the fact that there will be, you know, around half the population who voted against it. So I think either way, it's going to be a split population in the event of either a yes or a no vote, and there's going to be lots of very difficult discussions to be had either way.
Nina, you mentioned earlier that, for example, Spain is watching carefully what's going on in Scotland. Do you think they could learn something from this?
Oh, they absolutely want it to be a no vote. And it's very interesting because the Spanish Europe Minister was in the UK a few days ago speaking to a lot of media, saying things such as, you know, it'd be very difficult for Scotland to rejoin the EU as an independent country and you would have to join the euro, because they absolutely do not want their own regions to break away. And it's not only Spain. I mean, Belgium has its own independence movement going on as well. So the rest of the EU has very much, their official line has been, you know, we hope the United Kingdom stays together, because they realise what kind of flurry this could unleash upon the rest of Europe as well.
And what's going to happen if we get a yes vote?
Well, with regards to the EU, it also has a bearing on the rest of the United Kingdom's position in the EU. I mean, it's very interesting because, of course, the United Kingdom right now is in the process of renegotiating its relationship. However, if you imagine them losing Scotland, you know, this union has been together for over 300 years, they're going to go into those negotiations with the EU. First of all, will they even be ready after having those negotiations with Scotland? Are they going to be able to, those timelines are going to clash. Are they going to be ready to then enter into negotiations with the EU? They'll be massively damaged economically, demographically, and also psychologically tremendously scarred. So the UK would then probably go into a period of, you know, much soul searching, looking inward rather than trying to change their outward relationship with the EU and the rest of the world.
And Samira, a bit earlier you mentioned that indeed this is one of those things that's not all about rational thinking, it's about feeling and emotions as well. Why do you think we are seeing this happening now? It's been 307 years of United Kingdom.
I think it's a, well, first of all, on the most basic level, it's got a lot to do with the fact that you have a Scottish Nationalist Party in the devolved parliament in Scotland, and that this was always going to be something that they'd be pushing for. I think probably also more generally, when you have difficult economic times, you have people falling back on things like on sort of nationalist sentiment and so on, and the sort of flux engendered by a global economic crisis, I think, probably has its part to play as well. But it's also, I mean, the flavour of nationalism in Scotland has always been of a slightly different type to that you see in Wales, for instance. There's always been this sense of the Scottish nation as independent from England, and I think that it can't be discounted, as I said earlier, the emotional element. But I think also that something I was reading today that I thought was really interesting was that actually a poll about the social attitude survey showed that a huge proportion, I can't remember the exact percentage, of Scots feel very strongly British, and that percentage of people who feel British has actually risen during the campaign, despite the fact that you have this sort of neck and neck yes and no vote. So as I said earlier, I mean, in the event of either a yes vote or a no vote, there's going to be lots of questions to answer, whether it's, if it's a no vote, how you give Scotland the extra powers that it needs, and if it's a yes vote, how you reconcile the fact that much of the population sort of wants to be British.
Nina Sheikh, what do you think about the idea of smaller the better? Small nations are often seen as performing better, and it's been said that Scotland has been considering the small Nordic nations as one of sort of examples of what Scotland itself would like to be.
Well, of course, throughout this campaign, we've seen many parallels drawn with Norway. But the fundamental question, if you just look at it from an economic perspective, is the currency problem. And of course, that hasn't been resolved in this case. So many economists have come out saying, you know, this is disaster. Look at the lessons of the Eurozone crisis. You can't have current, if you don't have political union, then you can't have a currency union. So I think those are questions that are definitely going to come to the fore if indeed Scotland is independent. I think that might weigh on its economic standing and success.
And in either case, will the UK ever be the same again?
I think probably not, actually. I mean, you've had the three main party leaders of the UK promising that there would be further devolution if there's a no vote. And I think actually it's going to be a huge headache for them if there is a no vote, because they've made all sorts of promises, which I think will then cause politicians who are sort of looking out for England or Wales to ask a lot of questions. So why should Scotland have those benefits if there's no one sort of speaking for the English, if the Welsh aren't having that sort of extra devolution? So I think it's certainly going to change the shape of the UK either way.
Nina, do you agree?
Yes, certainly. I mean, as I mentioned when we first started talking about it, I think there's been a tremendous amount of complacency in the so-called Westminster elite. I mean, when Alex Salmond first started the SNP, only 2 years, you know, when he first started campaigning for this, there was, you know, he was almost laughed off. And the fact that he's done so much in such a short period of time shows that I think across not only the UK, but in Europe, there's just like a discontentment with the established ruling kind of political elite. And we see these kind of breakaway movements or movements towards independence and individuality, not only here in Scotland, but in the rest of Europe as well.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sipinina Sheikh of the Open Europe Think Tank here in London and the journalist Samira Shackle. It's time for a short break now, and when we are back, we'll assess the trade agreement signed between Ukraine and the EU, and we'll ask why disgruntled air passengers in Pakistan may herald a reawakening in the country's politics. Do stay with us.
There are lots of chunky themes running through the new October issue of Monocle. We survey the world of modern diplomacy. We send our autumn style guide down the editorial runway, deliver part two of our retail survey, and publish our fresh-faced guide to Auckland and New Zealand. Yes, it's a big action-packed issue, and here are our editors to tell you more about what to expect this month.
In the design section, we head to Greece to report on a new wave of architects that has come out of the crisis with a newfound patriotism and a keen ambition to help the nation back onto its feet. We then meet the bright lights of Brooklyn, the key players in the borough's increasingly world-class lighting industry, and then the new young upstart on Copenhagen's design scene. And then we cozy on down in two jealous-making homes, a Bauerhaus villa in Alsace and a summer house in Menorca.
In the edit section, we check out an age-old Portuguese porcelain maker building a business to last. Head to the Estonian capital to visit a portside suburb on the up and sit down with Martha Stewart for her perfect meal. We also survey the best in travel from New York to Jakarta and this month's foodie finds from Singapore to Sao Paulo.
The October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Why not become a subscriber? Head to monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2022 in Helsinki, 1822 here in London, and 10:22 a.m. in San Francisco. Still with me is Nina Sheikh of the Open Europe Think Tank here in London and the journalist Samira Shackle. Well, on Tuesday, the Ukrainian government signed a historic free trade agreement with the European Union, a set of proposals that came to be at the heart of the anti-government protests in Ukraine last year. But now, Ukraine's deputy foreign minister has resigned over the omission of a key clause in the trade agreement, which continues to trouble the relationship between Russia and the West. What we are seeing over here is a delay of over a year of a key part of the new EU-Ukraine association agreement. Nina Sheikh, what is the significance of this kind of an agreement if it's not really happening straight away?
Well, this is the agreement that started the unrest in the Ukraine to begin with, because the EU and Russia were both tussling over who would have closer economic ties with Ukraine. And when, you know, the former president decided to sign with Russia, he was ousted in the popular protest. Now, because this trade agreement has come into place, it's been ratified, but its implementation is only going to be in a year or so. That can be seen as a sweetener to Russia. You know, Putin and the other very important politician in Europe, Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, spoke and agreed to do this because, of course, for Russia, the fact that Ukraine is trying to have closer ties with the EU is something that they see as very threatening, and which is why, you know, the unrest in the eastern part of the eastern parts of Ukraine, even though there's supposedly a ceasefire, is still going on. And this is something that's going to continue, this tussling over what type of relationship Ukraine will have with the EU and how Russia will influence that. It's definitely not the end of this.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Ukraine's deputy foreign minister has now resigned over this delay. Do you think this is a signal of how devised divided the Ukrainian government is at the moment?
Yes, I mean, so the Ukrainian president Poroshenko has been quite perhaps you could call it realpolitik, being a bit, you know, more willing to make concessions to the Russians, whereas there are people in his government, notably his prime minister Yatsenyuk, who are much more pro-EU and want to go much harder on the Russians. Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, there'll be elections in October. So depending on who comes into government then in the Ukrainian government, we could see, you know, some politicians trying to go much harder on Russia and shunning away from Poroshenko's perhaps wise decision to also try and throw a bone to Russia, if you will.
Samira Shackel, after having followed the situation in Ukraine for some time, what do you think, what is the likelihood of peace being restored to that region, given that separatists still continue to demand full independence?
I think it's... If we've seen anything over the course of the Ukraine conflict, it's that it's been very unpredictable. And I think the fact that Ukraine is, as Nina's saying, so sort of stuck between these two powers, between the EU and Russia, I think... Yeah, it's sort of wanting to move closer to the EU. The EU is not so sure it wants to alienate Russia that much. And Russia's really, I don't think at the beginning of this whole process, anyone in power in Ukraine anticipated quite how strongly Russia would fight to keep its influence. So I think it's quite hard to say. And what I think between this sort of trade agreement and the concessions that were made and the sort of offer of autonomy to the separatists, in those provinces, which I think... those two things really illustrate how weakened the Kiev government is and how sort of restricted they are in what they can do. You've got separatists continuing to demand full independence. You've got Russia to continue to demand that the trade agreement is delayed.
Nina Shik, looking at that torn relationship both with Russia and with the EU, can you see any imaginable outcome of all this? What is the right balance for Ukraine?
Well, I think that throughout the crisis, what's become very evident and apparent is that, and you only need to study Russian and Ukrainian history for about 10 minutes to realize that no matter what happens, Russia is going to care a lot more about what happens in Ukraine than the EU. And that's the EU... Interestingly, the Ukrainian president recently has been really stepping up the rhetoric about how Ukraine would like to become an EU member state, they'd like to join NATO, whereas the EU partners have said whilst, you know, we want to develop Ukraine and we want to have them as a partner, they've been very hesitant to agree to those conditions of membership for Ukraine. So I think that Russia will continue to make sure that its influence is very much felt in Ukraine. And I think that the EU will be hesitant to want to take Ukraine on as an EU member because of its corruption, because of its economic problems and because of the strife that all caused with Russia.
Well, let's finally move to Pakistan, where passengers on a flight from Karachi to Islamabad voiced their outrage yesterday as the flight was delayed for 2 hours as it had to wait for two politicians to board the plane. When the lawmakers finally arrived, the passengers on board reacted furiously, finally forcing the two men off the craft. The scuffle that ensued was captured on a camera phone and has now gone viral in Pakistan, and this is an excerpt of it.
I'm sorry, they're all coming out. Because of you. It is your fault, sir. It is your fault, sir. I am sorry. Malik Sahab, you are not a minister anymore. You are not a minister anymore. And even if you are a minister, we don't care. We don't care anymore. We don't care anymore.
Samira Shackel, can you tell me a bit about the background to this? Why is there so much anger? I do understand waiting for 2 hours in a plane, but this reaction...
I think it's all to do with anger at the political class, and it's actually quite surprising, really, that this would happen. I mean, it's not surprising that a plane would be delayed for 2 hours, and bear in mind this is an internal flight that 2 hours is longer than the whole flight should have taken. For VIPs, there's a sort of very entrenched elite in Pakistan. The political classes and the sort of traditional landowning elites really sort of do what they want, and it's an intensely hierarchical and class-bound society. I think what's surprising here is you have the sort of so-called common man hitting back, and actually not just in the form of protest, but actually directly shouting at a politician. And this is a politician who, until the general election last May, was one of the most powerful in the country. He's a former interior minister. So it's a big thing. I think it sort of reflects growing anger with the perceived corruption of politicians who are sort of seen as getting rich while infrastructure flails and flounders and fails. And it's also to do with the growing political consciousness, I think, which in the urban centres many associate sort of attribute partly to, I think, the growth of political parties which very explicitly want to counter these traditional political dynasties, and also the sort of rising power of social media. And I think it's interesting that this was filmed on a camera phone and went viral on social media across Pakistan. That in itself shows a difference in how people are sort of communicating.
Do you think this video may have further consequences?
I'm not sure really. I think that it will. I think it's struck a nerve, certainly, and I think a lot of people watched it and just sort of said yes, and you see that in sort of comment pieces in the big national newspapers and so on. People were really, I think, quite enjoyed the feeling of seeing the politicians getting their comeuppance, essentially, and sort of sense of power to the people and so on. I don't know how much further reaching consequence it will have than that, but I think it's quite a notable thing in the context of this incredibly deferential hierarchical class system. It's really quite something.
That was Samira Shackle, journalist, together with Nina Sheikh of Open Europe think tank here in London. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres. Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll speak to the photographer Gauthier de Blonde on his new book Atelier, and we will review the week's theatre openings here in London. But before we get started on all that, here is Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
Both sides in Scotland's independence debate are making their final pitches to voters ahead of Thursday's referendum. The polls continue to suggest it's too close to call between the yes and no camps, and it's thought as many as 500,000 people still haven't decided which way they'll vote. President Obama's insisted American troops won't be sent into Iraq to fight Islamic State militants. In a speech to soldiers, sailors and airmen in Florida, he said the US would help Iraq's own forces to defeat the militants but wouldn't lead the fight. There have been gunshots and explosions at a college in the north of Nigeria. People have been seen running from the teacher training college in Kano, suspicion for the attacks likely to centre on the militant group Boko Haram. And the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could destroy the economies of the worst affected countries, according to the World Bank. It says only a speedy global response can prevent the collapse in Liberia, Guinea and Sierra Leone. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to Canada, and our contributor in Vancouver, Lucy Hislop, joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Lucy. Shall we start with the latest regarding Highway 16 in northern British Columbia, also known as the Highway of Tears?
Yes, absolutely. To give it some context, obviously it's a place where it is often in the kind of consciousness of many Canadians. Since the 70s, there have been 18 missing or murdered women in that area. And as you say, it's actually known now as the Highway of Tears. And many of those have been First Nations, Aboriginal women. And there's a strong task force that's been sort of searching. I mean, recently it's been talked about that it's had its sort of budget cut from $5 million to $1.8 million. It's called the EPANA force. So, you know, it's sort of kind of dropping off in terms of the sort of money that's being put into it, and yet there aren't the kind of results that are coming from that. But we had this week one of Canada's youngest serial killers who was convicted, Cody Ledger-Burkoff, and he had four counts of first-degree murder in that area, and two of which were Aboriginal women. And the judge made the comment that, you know, more needs to be done to address the sort of underlying causes that put Aboriginal women at risk, and obviously at risk now means you know, either they're sex workers or they're wrestling with addiction issues. And so the debate comes up that, you know, especially this week with his comments, that, you know, whether it's just a criminal issue of looking for the people who committed these crimes, whether it's just a criminal issue, or whether, you know, to be dealt with by the police, or whether there's a sociological phenomenon. And one of the key sort of things this week was a launch by, this is mainly for First Nations across Canada, of a social media campaign where this woman called Holly Jarrett in Halifax, PAX, made a hashtag, which is Am I Next? I mean, it's a very powerful way of bringing attention to the fact that Aboriginal women have often been targeted, who have been disappeared or been murdered. And it's, yes, it's really prominent in Canadians' minds.
Can you tell me more about that campaign, Am I Next?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, her name was Holly Jarrett, and she's in Halifax. And there's a personal connection. Her cousin was Loretta Saunders. She was an Inuit woman who was found dead along the Trans-Canada Highway in the east, as opposed to in the Highway of Tears. But it highlights the fact that, you know, across the country, there are reportedly more than 1,000 cases of missing or murdered Aboriginal women. So, yes, she is standing there with the hashtag, Am I Next? It just kind of goes to show the kind of disproportionate number of First Nations being targeted. So, yes, it's very poignant.
So, Lucy, shall we leave Highway of Tears now and continue with the saga of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford? What is the latest?
Absolutely. Well, obviously, first off, we need to wish Rob Ford well. He's been told that he has a tumour in his abdomen, and I believe this afternoon we will get the results of his biopsy. Presumably he's already knows what's going on, but it's going to be made public. But what, of course, you know, calling him a colourful politician is somewhat of an understatement, and you know, a lot of people will know about Rob Ford. He's the one who was caught smoking crack on camera, and certainly a few videos of him drinking. He's certainly very colourful. And what has happened is, since he's been in hospital, at very much the last minute before the mayoral election kicks off in earnest, before October is the election date, his brother has stepped in to carry the torch for him. And his nephew has moved aside in a ward so that Doug actually can still run as a councillor, not as mayor, but as a councillor. So it's kind of being branded as the great switcheroo around here, and so that Ford Nation will still be sort of up and running despite Rob being in hospital. And I believe that Doug's been kind of classed as the third behind the front runner, who is called John Tory. And his, you know, so his brother's votes are clearly going kind of Doug's way so far. He's a far less humorous figure, but he definitely seems to have appeared to have picked up the vote.
So, Lucy, I was reading a recent article on this topic, and Rob Ford said to this paper that he didn't want to let his supporters down and that he hoped that they would understand. Maybe a nasty question, but does he actually have supporters left after all these scandals?
Yes, absolutely. when I think about how Doug is in third place, he's only a point behind the second place. So, you know, we're not talking about massively behind. No, he's definitely a figure of sort of equal of admiration, and, you know, he's done a lot for the city in sort of over his tenure. So he's definitely, people still have a lot of admiration for him.
Lucy, let's finish with something slightly more positive. There is a book. Well, actually, there is a kickstart campaign to publish a book. That's of a unique 1970s tree planters in British Columbia.
Yeah, I just love this story because it's just such a snapshot of, I think, everything that means that British Columbia means. After the logging and the sort of huge swathes of clear cutting of cedars and old growth and lots of forests in BC, there were a lot of tree planters that came in, and you know, many of them have millions of trees that they have planted over their time. So it's pretty monumental. But they came in as tree planting contractors. It was a pretty hippie-ish time, of course, sort of 77 to kind of 87. And this Kickstarter by Nahini Artson is wanting to get all these fantastic pictures that she sort of suddenly came across out there, you know, of dogs and night fires and old makeshift baths and trucks. It's a great snapshot. And, of course, she was born herself in a teepee, so it really doesn't get more West Coast than that.
Lucy Hislop, Monocle's contributor in Vancouver, thank you very much for joining us. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll meet the photographer Gauthier de Blonde on his new book that chronicles the interiors of artists' workspaces. That is right after this.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Well, after 10 years of work, photographer Gauthier de Blonde has published a new book, and it is called Atelier. For this book, de Blonde has photographed artists' working spaces around the world. From studios in America to Asia, Gauthier visits studios of world-renowned artists such as Ai Weiwei, Jeff Koons and Wim Delvoye. Well, I'm delighted to say that Gauthier de Blonde himself joins me now in the studio. Welcome to the program. Can you tell me about the background for this project? What made you so interested in the spaces where artists work?
Well, I've worked with artists for 20 years. So it came to kind of logic after I photographed artists since the 90s, lived in London full time, so mixed with the group of artists called the YBA at the time. So doing portraits, doing artist book with them allowed me to visit studios for 20 years. And it seems and it felt to me that then the studio was probably the best portrait of the artists. It kind of revealed more about the artist than maybe just a face or him or her walking on a canvas. I thought the artist was actually the studio was actually more revealing to about the artist himself.
Are you saying that you are basically more interested in the working spaces than the artists themselves?
No, it's not entirely true, actually. I'm interested about the space, yes, but actually the space belongs to one person who has such a strong personality that you actually have to deal with the artist through the space. It's sometimes difficult to do a portrait of an artist in his studio because of his personality. They know how to control the image. It's sometimes difficult to get where you want to be. Being by yourself in their space, they as long as they trust you, they open the door, they leave, and it's a kind of bit more of an equal relationship, the space and yourself, and you do try to do what you want really there.
How difficult were the people you were dealing with? Would they always say yes when you approached them with this suggestion to come and take photos?
Most of them, I have to say yes, they said yes. No one was difficult in search. I mean, the one who, I've met most of them and some actually said clearly, you can come that time because I won't be around. So they didn't want to meet me or to see me at the time. Few said no, and everyone who said no always kind of gave the same reason for that. I mean, it's too private. That was really what stopped some of the artists. But most of them were intrigued by the project because I actually approached them to ask them to do their portrait without them, which they did find it surprising, but interesting. So that was actually easy to get an answer. What was difficult is to get there at the right time. I didn't want to go into the space when it was empty or after they just finished an exhibition. I wanted to see the work in progress. I wanted some energy in the studio.
Well, Gauthier, did you learn something about creativity when you were visiting all these places and taking photos? Did you see similarities between some of the greatest artists of our time and where they work?
No, I mean, what actually is surprising is most of the book made with painters and sculptors, but they're actually being all artists. They're all very different. They all organize their studio differently, their day differently. Some will work under pressure and will make the work at the last minute. Some will actually paint all year long, even if they don't have an exhibition plan anywhere. No, it's very much like going into somebody's home. We all have the same needs in our life in some ways, wishes, but we all quite different and all a different individual, and that really come across the studio.
Could you describe me the studio you found to be most impressive?
The most impressive. I mean, I think there are different categories of studios. You have the studios where the artist is always on show. By that I mean and the work is being made in the studio, but the doors are open and the work is there to be seen. So you have regular visits by curators, critics, writers, and so the studio is very much organized to make sure that the work is there to be seen. And the opposite of that, you have studios who work like it's the brain of the artist. It looks messy, but it's actually a very organized mess. But it's much more intimate and private, and you're not necessarily usually invited there. But probably what impressed me is when you go, for example, to Asia, they have spaces so big that sometimes they use only one little corner and they don't know what to do with the rest. And in some respect, the spaces in Europe are much more smaller because we are many living in Europe with not as much land than we'd find in Asia or America. So the space respond to that. And it's actually very expensive, obviously, in London, Paris, New York, I mean, Berlin, to get big spaces. So that's the main difference. But I think the big surprise for me was, in some ways, they're all big white cube, but they're all incredibly different because it's all depend on one strong personality. It really depends on the artist, how the studio look at the end of the day.
Well, what do you think now of the old stereotype that all creative people are messy?
I don't agree. I don't agree. A lot of artists, I would say younger artists maybe, or less known artists, will have a messier studio, not because they're messy, but because they just don't have the time, or they don't have the money to pay people or assistant technician to clean after them. You realize that very well-established artists, some of them I've worked with, they actually incredibly organized, and they have the team of people who can actually make sure that the studio stays clean and well thought for the work. It's usually when the studio is actually very well organized for the work, it's because they have the team of people who can take care of it. It takes time to clean. I mean, we all know that in our home, but that's the way it works. They're not messy because they want to be messy because the artist. They usually are realized when it's a bit messy, it's because they don't have time. They just don't have time to clean after each day.
All these amazing photos are in the book that's called Atelier, and it is indeed out now, and it is by Gauthier de Blonde. Before I let you go, do you have plans for your next book project?
Well, I hope it would become a book, but I'm actually working with a group of artists in Vienna, in Göging. It's a small village outside of Vienna. It's a group of Artbrut artists. It was an old psychiatric hospital, and they live and they work there. There are 13 of them right now, and I think they do great work. And so maybe in 2 years' time, I'll come back to you.
Photographer Gauthier de Blonde, thank you very much for
this.
21:49 in Moscow, 18:49 in London, 13:49 in New York City. We continue with a bit of music. In honour of Scotland's referendum tomorrow, let's hear from one of Scotland's finest. This is the Eurythmics with Sweet Dreams. That was Sweet Dreams by the Eurythmics here on Monocle 24. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it is time now to review the best in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more. And today we talk theatre, and I am delighted to say that I'm joined by Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International New York Times. Welcome to the programme, Matt.
Thank you very much.
What kind of a theatre week has this been?
Well, it's
so
been
far.
Full of oddities, full of eccentricities, full of plays that kind of defy categorization, where the actors have to do unusual things and where the audience sometimes have to respond in unusual ways. I mean, for instance, the most recent of the openings was a play at the National Theatre called Ballyturk. This is a 90-minute Irish play by Enda Walsh, who won the Tony Award a few years ago for the musical Once. And Once is very kind of linear, and I suppose you could say it's quite old-fashioned in its romance. This play is entirely unusual, quirky. It's even hard to tell exactly what's going on.
Can you try?
Well, sure, I'm always happy to try. There are three men who are called 1, 2, and 3, and you see the first two of them, Killian Murphy and Mikkel Murphy, different Murphys, and they are sort of the first 50% of the play, and then the back wall of the set falls away, and we see the wonderful Irish actor Stephen Ray looking like a kind of mafia don dressed in a dark suit, and he sort of emerges speaking very softly as what? The figure of death? A sort of vision of mortality. And what happens is as soon as he enters the action, the tone and the pace of the play change dramatically. Up until he arrives, it's very antic. It's very knockabout. It's like a kind of Marx Brothers movie, or a lot of people have invoked Buster Keaton. Killian Murphy must lose about a stone per performance. I've rarely seen somebody sweating up such a storm. But then Stephen Ray comes in, and it's basically, it turns into a riff on Beckett and Waiting for Godot. And it, let's just say, it's very, very Irish. Anyone who's ever seen an Irish play, who's ever been to an Irish pub, will recognize the language, the rhythms, the sort of impetus of it. I liked it a lot. The energy of it is off the charts. And honestly, these actors give 150%.
I'm trying to understand what's going on the stage. Can you still shed a bit of light
Sure.
off what themes this play is dealing with?
Well, the themes are these two guys, 1 and 2, who are in a room that deliberately has no windows. The set basically consists of lots of cupboards. So do the cupboards open onto a different world? I'm not going to give anything away. I couldn't possibly do that. We're a spoiler-free zone here. But as I say, this third character does enter the action. Ballyturk itself is a fictional Irish town, and the Irish love sort of fictional versions of themselves. And so 1 and 2 give versions of the Irish populace whom you're not seeing. And then it has to change. Death has to enter the equation. You can't be manic and antic the whole time. And more than that, it's up to you.
That sounds quite special. So you said you enjoyed that very much. I wonder if you enjoyed it as much as you did enjoy The Wolf from the Door, which is playing at the Royal Court.
Well, maybe I'm getting soft in my old age, but I enjoyed that as well. That one, it's very easy to tell what's going on, although what's going on is very weird, but
again,
it's quite clear. It's clear in its weirdness, if that makes sense. You've got a very elegant aristocratic woman, Lady Catherine, played brilliantly by the wonderful Anna Chancellor, who many listeners still know as Duckface from Four Weddings and a Funeral. And she befriends this young homeless guy called Leo, who in the very first scene takes all his clothes off. And he asks this aristocratic woman to place her hand on his buttock, which she does. And that then prompts a sort of relationship between the two of them that turns out to be forged on the back of terrorism. And they are going to bring low all of Britain and all of the sort of things that we hold dear in the UK, like, for instance, the Houses of Parliament. And it basically ends with a vision of the apocalypse and this young homeless guy being the new ruler of a new post-apocalyptic Britain. But it's quite witty. It's very light on its feet. It's beautifully directed by James MacDonald. The acting by the four actors is superb. And it's a very Royal Court kind of play. The Royal Court loves plays in which the British are upended or raised to the ground. So this is variations on a Royal Court theme.
That sounds very good as well. And shall we continue straight away with your third play for today's review?
Yeah, this is theatrically perhaps the most obvious, but in some ways also probably for the spectator the most fun. At the press night the other week, the audience at the end leapt to its feet without a minute's hesitation. It's called Fully Committed by Becky Mode. It's a revival of a play at the Meunier Chocolate Factory in South London that was first done a decade ago at the Meunier Chocolate Factory in South London. And it's about, it's set in Manhattan, and it's about a struggling actor working the restaurant bookings in the basement of a very posh restaurant, which, you know, you've lived in New York, you know how hard it is in New York to get a table at your favorite restaurant. Now it would all be done on a computer or whatever. But this is, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they still keep restaurant ledgers. So this guy plays more than 40 characters, most of whom are people trying to get a booking, but some of them are like the chef, the proprietor, a restaurant critic who's not happy that he shows up and his table isn't there, somebody who doesn't want to have to clean the loo, so this poor guy has to go clean the loo, and his father, the chap's father, who wants to know whether he'll be home for Christmas, and that depends on whether the chef and the restaurant staff will give him the holidays off. So Kevin Bishop is the one actor playing 40-plus roles, and he is the busiest, hardest working actor in London, and Cillian Murphy in Ballyturk is the second hardest working actor in London.
It sounds like a lot of work for Kevin Bishop, 40 roles.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I'm not an actress, what do I know? But my impression is there's probably a wild adrenaline rush that comes from doing this. And it's like, you know, doing downhill skiing very fast. Once you start, you can't stop. And then you get that huge whoosh at the end when the audience rises as one to thank you.
Well, Matt, we've been talking about three different plays now. If you should choose one recommendation for the coming weekend, can I put you in that position? Can you pick one?
Yeah, I would pick, perhaps controversially, I would pick The Wolf from the Door because I think it's a very clever, witty variation on the kind of play we think we've seen. And then you see this play and you realize you haven't seen it done this well.
Amazing. Thank you very much. That was Matt Wolf, London theatre critic for the International New York Times. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Erin Duffy. Our studio manager was Sean Mullervy. Next after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs with Monocle's Daniel Ciacopelli. Then at 2200 hours London time is The Monocle Daily. And tonight the team brings you a special Monocle 24 documentary on the historic vote in Scotland tomorrow. That is Scotland's Choice coming up on tonight's edition of The Monocle Daily at 22:30 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, and from me, Markus Hippi, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.